This is a CBC podcast.
Ray Shefska sold cars for 43 years. And in that time, he learned...
There's three truisms in the car business. The price of my new car is more than what you're going to want it to be. The amount we're going to offer you for your trade is less than what you think it should be. And either you or somebody you know has been screwed by a car dealer.
Ouch. But hey, Ray moved a lot of units. And not just because he was a nice guy. Hi, I'm Paul Havershrood. Today on The Cost of Living, the art of the sale. And the ways they use the oldest tricks in the book to get us to buy. Like the forever sale. You know, when stuff is 80% off. Hey, great, what a deal. But if everything is always 80% off, is it really ever on sale? Or how about what you hear? Is that music playing in the store really just there for your listening pleasure? Huh. Up first, the hard sell. Ray Shefska started selling cars in the 1970s. Back then, he was trained to be, well, let's be generous and call it pushy.
You were taught to never let the customer leave. You were taught to keep them there at all costs. The longer they're there, the greater the likelihood they'll wear down and finally say yes.
How did he keep a customer in the showroom? He couldn't exactly handcuff them to the desk, but...
You verbally handcuff them to the desk. Okay, let me just check with my manager one more time, okay? So if I understand this correctly, if we can get to this number, you're taking the... Let me check with my boss just one more time. And then what happens in the automobile industry, it's what's known as a TO, a turnover. So if the salesperson can't close the customer, they turn them over to someone else. And then when the customer still says no... Well, then the manager will say, well, give me one more minute. And then the next thing you know, maybe the general manager's coming out there. But the turnover, the TOs, will continue until you wear the customer down.
In the car business, Ray says you're taught that time equals commitment. If a customer talks to you for 3 hours, takes a test drive, they'll be more likely to sign on the dotted line.
Surveys that manufacturers do, the thing that customers complain about the most is the amount of time it takes to make a car deal. Well, the amount of time it takes is because that's the way the dealership wants it, because that'll wear the people down. So it still goes on today.
The hard sell may not be the oldest trick in the book, but it's been around. 100 years ago, there was the slick-talking door-to-door salesman. Well, sir, there's nothing on earth like a genuine, bona fide, electrified six-car monorail. In the 50s, the post-war boom took it to even another level. The population was growing, factories were cranking out new products, and salespeople, they pushed those products, using tactics that gave the hard sell its bad reputation. And yet, the hard sell hasn't gone away. So why not? Jim Sobotchka is a marketing professor at Creighton University. He says, yeah, the tricks of the trade that make up the hard sell are still alive and well.
Any type of sales event where you're feeling pressured, the always be closing kind of approach.
A, B, C. A, always, B, B, C, closing. Always be closing. Always.
Sort of the Glengarry Glen Ross approach where, you know, whatever it takes to make the sale.
Hey, coffee is for closers. The hard sell comes in many forms. Urgency. This deal is only good for today. Scarcity. We only have two left. Limited time offers. Call now and get a second set of steak knives. At the core of these pitches, time and pressure. The hard sell tries to get us to buy immediately without considering other options. And Take it from Ray. It can work.
I'm pretty sure I sold over $1 billion worth of cars in my lifetime. I mean, you know, I managed some decent-sized dealerships, selling 150, 200 cars a month.
Ray didn't use the hard sell to move all those cars. But when he did, he knew he was tapping into something the customer may not fully understand. Jim Zabochka describes it as instincts trumping reason.
I think the hard sell is more appealing to the lizard brain a little bit, like, oh, we got to get this done, and, you know, this is, you need this, and this is why, and let's go and let's do it today because you can't go another day without this product or whatever the case may be, you know?
This is part of the psychological power of the hard sell. Most of us don't like it, but it's also not really working on our rational brains, more on how we're feeling. And the sense of urgency it creates helps to bypass our more logical decision-making. Another thing the hard sell takes advantage of? Most people are generally pretty nice.
I think a lot of people just go along to get along a little too often, right? People are sometimes very timid about interactions, and maybe it's a fear of the fear of confrontation a lot of people have. They just kind of go along and figure, well, this is just kind of how it is.
The hard sell isn't going to work on all of us all of the time, but it works enough that it's worth it. It often shows up in industries that deal in volume. Telemarketing, timeshare pitches, infomercials. Shoot enough shots and a few will go in.
I've often heard in sales, it's a numbers game, right? Like the more people you talk to, the more you will sell. And I've experienced it as a salesperson, like, okay, here's how you want to go about this. Try to close within this amount of time. If it's not happening, get them off the phone or whatever the case may be.
That's one approach to sales, and it's legit. Where the hard sell can break bad is when aggressive crosses the line into dishonest, making false claims about a product, omitting information, just straight up lying. Jim says those kinds of tactics often only work when the buyer doesn't know as much as the person who's selling. But here, score one for the internet.
Given all the knowledge we have as consumers these days, which is way beyond what it once was, the salesperson's role tends to have shifted over the years in most positions to more of a, I don't know, information manager, knowledge manager. Like, you know a lot of stuff, and I'm willing to admit that as your expert, but let me tell you what's important and what isn't.
That kind of gentler approach is what's in fashion now. Jim's research shows that customers don't like the hard sell. We lose trust in the salesperson. Yeah, sure, they might make the sale, but we probably won't go back to them. The hard sell doesn't do relationships. Reshevska realized years ago that it wasn't for him. He didn't want to sell one person one car. He wanted to sell them a car and their kids a car.
It shouldn't be contentious. It shouldn't be a battle of wits and will. It shouldn't be who won. It should be nobody wins. Everybody's happy. I sold a car. You bought a car. You got treated fairly. I made a fair profit. Let's all move on with life.
That's a much softer sell. But if you want to hear more about the hard sell, just let me check with my manager. We've got some cost of living mugs in the back. I think we can... Hold on. Just let me ask. Just stay here. Don't change the dial. I'll be right back. This is The Cost of Living. I'm Paul Haberschrood. Have you ever walked by a store with a banner that hollered, "Everything, 80% off"? So you went in and, yeah, that is one deep discount on that spatula. 6 months later, you walk by the same store and everything is still 80% off. Come on. If everything is always on sale, is it really a sale?
Darian Kovacs is a child of the 80s, so he remembers what it was like to wait for stuff to go on sale.
Black Friday used to be an actual thing. Boxing Day used to be a thing. We used to wake up early on Boxing Day and go down to AMB Sound to get those limited quantity of flat screen TVs that were available.
Darian runs Jelly Marketing in Langley, BC. He says, we're not lining up outside electronics stores anymore. We're shopping in our PJs, popping Cheetos, and letting the sales come to us.
Yeah, and there isn't a website you can't go to where you can get 10% off by signing up to their email. And so because of 24/7 shopping, it's become the need and the desire for consumers to have 24/7 sales.
And retailers are happy to comply. Sales are a powerful way to move product. But just because something is on sale doesn't mean you're getting a great bargain. Steve Santisi is an advertising and competition lawyer in Toronto.
One could argue, I think very reasonably, that a sale could be a cent, a dollar, as long as there has been a discount.
The store doesn't have to tell you what the old price was. It can just say, hey, these knives are on sale.
One day and one day only.
Another slick move retailers use.
Beat the clock and get up to $1,500 off.
Creating a sense of urgency.
And 15% off everything else. These amazing offers end Monday.
But if those offers don't end Monday, a company could land in hot water. Last fall, the Canadian furniture chain Dufresne was fined $3.25 million for offering the same promotion over and over. In other words, its limited time offer wasn't really limited.
I have clients that have received warning letters from the Competition Bureau saying, we're watching you, we're monitoring your so-called sale prices, you better tidy this up.
Steve Santisi says cracking down on false and misleading sale claims is a top priority for the Competition Bureau. Over the last two decades, it's brought challenges against The Bay, Sears, Amazon. But Steve says it can't catch them all.
Generally speaking, the Bureau does not often go after the small players because they have limited resources and budgets, so they tend to pursue these kinds of issues with the larger retailers and in some particular sectors, particularly furniture and appliances.
Darian Kovacs says the only way to know if a sale is truly a sale is to do your homework. If you really want a new set of pots and pans, track the price over time.
Yeah, I can tell you what I do myself. I actually put some items in my bookmark of things I want to get. I watch it for a while, like sometimes almost, 30 to 45 days.
Maybe you'll save money and earn some bragging rights.
I think there is a social part of all of us that wants to go out and tell people, hey, I got this shirt 50% off. It used to be 40, now it was 20. Because that's the way to win at life. You can win at life by getting that sale.
For the cost of living, I'm Danielle Nerman. Oh, what's that? You like my shoes? I got them on sale.
This is The Cost of Living. I'm Paul Havershood. Ellis Cho, when you walk into a store these days, the stuff that happens around you, not a lot of what's going on is an accident.
No, you're right. Businesses really think hard about everything about their business, their location, what the place feels like, what it looks like. And they even think about what it sounds like. Walk through any mall and you'll hear a dozen different songs. And what you hear is thereby design.
So today, we're talking about the oldest tricks in the book. Is music one of them?
It absolutely is. And it kind of goes way back to the 30s, when Muzak became the first company to produce background music for businesses.
Dig that smooth groove.
Yeah, see? It works. Muzak wanted to make the whole experience of shopping better for customers and workers. And now most people actually prefer some kind of background music. According to a 2023 UK study, more than 80% of people think it creates a better atmosphere. And nearly half found it awkward when no music was playing.
So is this why businesses play music? Because, like, we don't like awkward silences. Ellis, Ellis, that was, we don't like awkward silences. Fine. Point proven.
See? No, it's to get you in the mood to buy. Because if it's done right, music can boost sales. And there are people whose job it is to make sure it's done right.
We put together a blueprint and we include some playlist samples. So things like what are the energy ranges that we would advise? What are the sorts of moods that we want to explore musically as well?
James Picken is the creative director at Startle, a UK-based company that curates playlists for businesses.
Okay, first of all, one, how can I get his job?
Yeah.
And two, what does all that entail?
Well, he and his team try to find the right music to create the right mood for customers.
If the music fits well, your experience is going to be a lot more pleasurable. You're going to stay there a lot longer.
And presumably, the longer you stay in a store, the more likely you are to buy.
Yeah, that's the idea. And not only that, but music can also influence what you buy. There's a study from the 90s that tested this theory in a wine store.
They played French music and French wine sales increased, and they played German music and German wine sales increased. And that just shows you how powerful that choosing music that fits product can have on something like sales.
And it wasn't just a dinky little difference either. When French music was playing, customers bought 3 times more French wine than German wine. And the same thing happened when they played German music.
But if you don't like Kraftwerk, right? German wine sales in trouble, you're out of there.
Well, James says stores aren't really catering to our personal tastes. They're just looking for music that fits the brand. Like at a Nike store, you're going to hear like this pumping music, right? Something that's more energetic, gets you moving. At a place like Banana Republic, you'll hear something more subdued, like, you know, less bouncy.
So the purpose of it isn't to play music that people like. It's to help build an atmosphere and a mood overall. And that might not necessarily be music that people know. It might not maybe be music that people like, but does it help create a mood? Does it perhaps promote a certain behavior?
So what kind of behaviors are they trying to promote?
Well, that depends. Do they want you to shop more or shop faster? We all have this physiological response to music, right? Like slower music can reduce your heart rate. It's relaxing, and that could keep you shopping longer. There are a couple of seminal studies from the 80s that proved this. They found slower music increased sales at a supermarket.
All right, but what if that supermarket threw on, you know, like the uncha uncha and really pounded out those beats?
That same study showed that up-tempo music made people shop faster and buy less. James says it also has another potential effect. Like, say it's really early in the morning and a coffee shop is playing thumpin' fast music.
It's going to create those sorts of anxious feelings within the listener. It's going to create friction when they walk into the store.
All right, so you don't want to go into Tim Hortons for your double-double and just like hear Fatboy Slim just pounding.
No, you kind of want to start your day a little bit more calmer. But sometimes, Paul, that's what stores want. Like if checkout lines are getting really long and they want people to move faster and get faster turnover, they'll play faster music to get you out of there.
Do you think you move faster, Ellis, if you're hearing like an up-tempo, like a really hoppy song? Are you just moving around the store faster or moving around anywhere faster?
I think so. Like even when you think about exercise, you actually move faster. Your heart rate goes up.
Huh. Yeah, I'll buy that. Okay, so if you're a store then, is there like the perfect shopping tempo, the music that it's just right, it's getting people to want to buy?
Well, James says there is a sweet spot. He says a mid-tempo song that hits around 90 to 110 beats per minute, that does the trick. And he thinks there's one band that fits that groove.
I think a lot of Fleetwood Mac would actually work particularly well. There's a gentle energy in a lot of their songs. I think, you know the song Everywhere by Fleetwood Mac? I think that tempo is probably a perfect tempo.
Okay, so you walk in the store, you hear that, ooh, wah, I want to be with you ever. And it's going to be like a landslide for your wallet.
Yeah, be prepared to spend.
All right. Thanks, Ellis.
You're welcome.
On your radio and by podcast, this is The Cost of Living. I'm Paul Habershrood. So the average person, we can detect 10,000 different odors. Yeah, our olfactory senses are working overtime. And retailers know what we smell can change how we feel. But can it also nudge us to buy? Jenny DeRosio, in a story that first ran last year, went shopping to find out.
I'm at a mall in Calgary, standing outside Abercrombie and Fitch. Not even in the store yet. But I noticed something. What is that smell?
It just feels like a very, like, iconic Abercrombie smell. Like, I feel like I can't remember coming to Abercrombie ever and it, like, not smelling like this. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know how to describe it. It's, like, very cologne-esque.
Cologne, yeah, honestly.
There's, like, a candle scent called, like, Freshly Washed Man. Kind of smells like that.
Freshly Washed Man. So, not a bad smell. Something pleasant? Now, these customers don't shop at Abercrombie & Fitch because of how it smells, but having a signature fragrance doesn't hurt either. It's called sensory marketing, and it's a powerful tool that can make you think about a store after you've left.
So let's say you take something from Abercrombie & Fitch. You go home, and you smell that smell again, and you think of Abercrombie & Fitch, and you say, oh, you know, Abercrombie. So it's in your mind, and then you might go back to them to buy something else. It's like an advertisement which they are not paying for.
That's University of Michigan marketing professor Aradhana Krishna. She says smell is linked neurologically to memory and emotion. You smell popcorn and want to immediately sit down to a movie. That association can keep consumers coming back again and again. Krishna points to one famous example, the scent of white flowers with a playful twist of coriander and pine.
Welcome aboard Singapore Airlines.
Yes, pine, at 30,000 feet in the air.
They not only sprayed a scent that was designed for them into their space, which is aircrafts and Singapore Airlines, but also to spray the same scent into products which were there within their space. So in Singapore Airlines, it was face towels or even the laundry for the steward and stewardess's uniforms.
That scent is called Batik Flora. The airline describes it as a springtime walk at sunrise after a light drizzle. But nailing the right signature scent for your airline cabin or store isn't easy.
Bath & Body Works is like the most like aggressive smelling store I've ever been to in my life. I hate going in there because it gives me a headache.
Krishna says powerful scents can attract one customer while repelling another.
It's difficult to come up with something which is uniquely appreciated by your target audience if your target audience is very diverse. I mean, diverse in terms of gender and age group, cultural background. So if it's very homogenous and it's easier to come up with something that everybody would appreciate.
And some smells just don't stand the test of time. Abercrombie & Fitch used to have a signature scent called Fierce. But it was too closely associated with the oversexed Abercrombie & Fitch brand of the 90s. The store has since toned it down a little.
I remember back when I was like, you know, in high school, it used to have a very much of a stronger scent, I would say. But yeah, like now it's not as bad, not as like perfumed, I guess you could say.
For The Cost of Living, I'm Jenny DeRosio.
Coming up next week, how do you feel about eating alone in a restaurant? These days, more people, like Kyle Prescott, are doing it.
I dine alone probably, at this point, maybe about once a week. If I had to choose between going with friends, family, or myself, I would choose myself. You know, my family, my sister, friends who are now getting into families, it's very hard to bring everyone together. Meanwhile, I literally can pick up and say, I would like to have a 6 p.m. dinner today, or I want to have a 10 p.m. dinner today.
Restaurants are adding more tables for one because of people like Kyle. The Economics of Solo Dining. That's next week. That's all for the show. The Cost of Living is based in Calgary. The show is produced by Daniel Nerman, Ellis Cho, and Jennifer Keane, with help from Caroline Ferris. I'm Paul Habershrood. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.